Hallo, ich bin der andere Ami, David Guerra, und willkommen nach der 40BerlinBrigade.com Podcast. As I said, hello, I am David Guerra, and welcome to the 40th episode of the BerlinBrigade.com Podcast. I am also a former member of Alpha Company, 6th Battalion, 502nd Infantry, Berlin Brigade, United States Army. And I thank you for taking the time to join me today on this, the greatest podcast exclusively dedicated to all the men and women that ever served and supported the mission of the United States Army's most illustrious and most prestigious unit, the Berlin Brigade and the Berlin Command. Hey, how's your summer going so far? Any vacations? Any reunions? Oh, wait a minute. We'll get to that in just a bit. So listen, without any further delay and before the temperature gets any hotter out there, los geht's mit diesen Podcast.
Wait for it. Welcome to the BerlinBrigade.com Podcast with your host, David Guerra. It's time for the special announcements.
I have one announcement to make before we begin the interview, and it comes from Arvel Perry. He wrote us an email, and he writes, I don't know if this is posted anywhere on your site, but about 25 former members of Bravo 26 and Bravo 4th of the 502nd from the 1980s will be reuniting on June 22nd through the 24th of 2012 in Las Vegas, Nevada. For most of us, it will be our first get-together in almost 30 years. Nothing formal is planned, just a few meals and some casino hopping. But I wanted to share this info, if anyone else might be interested. For those of you on Facebook and are interested, please search for the Facebook group Bravo 4th of the 502nd Infantry. Sincerely, Arvel Perry. Hey everybody, if you're in the Vegas area and you want to meet up with some Berlin Brigade pals, buddies, and you served in Bravo 26 or Bravo 4th of the 502nd, and you know what, drop Arvel Perry a note. He's on our registry, or look him up there on Facebook. And have a great time, everyone. Everybody that's going, if you're going there for a reunion or not a reunion, you're going on summer vacation, everybody have a great time. And, just like the group that just recently went, those Berlin Red Legs, again, they had a great time from what I've been able to pick up. Obviously, they haven't told the entire story, but then again, I guess it's true. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. So there you go. Listen, everybody, that's it for the announcements. Let's move on.
Take your seats, because it's time for the special guest interview!
Hey everybody, joining me today again is Colonel John Alvarado, U.S. Army retired. He joins us again. We had such a great conversation the first time that we just decided, hey, you know what, let's do this all over again. But we're not going to talk about the same stuff. Well, maybe a little bit, but not too much. Then He was Captain Alvarado with the Rail Transportation Office from February of 1986 to February of 1989. He was there at the Berlin Lichterfelde West Bahnhof and the RTO, the Rail Transportation Office. And hey, welcome back, John.
Thank you very much, Dave.
How's it going? How's life? As we're recording right now, everybody, today is June the 27th, and John, as he mentioned last time, is in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, John, do you have any update on what's the situation there, environmentally-wise, there in the state?
Oh, well, we're having a lot of, extremely hot weather, but most recently we just had the forest fire. Two major forest fires broke out, one just a little bit north of Santa Fe, and then another one up in near the Los Alamos Laboratories in the Los Alamos County, and that fire is just kicking up really strong today. My wife just called me and told me that they were having a mandatory evacuation of Los Alamos, the city of Los Alamos. Last night it was a voluntary evacuation. It's actually become more serious. Now it's a mandatory. So we're tracking the news on that today here locally.
Wow. And here I thought that New Mexico was just all desert. See what I know.
Well, it's a beautiful up north. The lower half is pretty much high desert and desert. And the upper half is mountainous terrain.
Well, at least, that's the part I've seen on heading out to, Fort Bliss and stuff out that way in West Texas. And what's that little White Sands National Park?
Yep.
Or National Monument? Yeah, that's all I've seen. So I haven't gone north yet, but there are plans to go north.
That's good. We'll enjoy it. It's providing that we still have a forest left.
Right. Wow. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought I muted my microphone. I'm over here talking. Well, hey, tell you what, let's get back into this. We had some great conversation. We're talking about life in Berlin for then Captain Alvarado. And kind of life after Berlin. But let's get back to Berlin and really interesting stories there on the duty train. So, hey, if you want to let us get back in, but we've got a serious one a little bit later on that we'll get into. But for right now, if you don't mind, give us a little bit more light on what went on in that duty train that we normally didn't get to see as passengers.
Well, the duty train, you know, was kind of a unique experience for everybody. You know, it was unusual, you know, that we provided rail service, and the passengers were always part of the story. I mean, that's you can't talk about the Berlin duty train without talking about the people that traveled on the train and the stories that they created. You know, well, every morning my train commanders would come off the train and they'd come in and they'd file the report with me about the different incidents that took place. And most of the incidents were just about stories about the people transiting the corridor by rail and, you know, either the problems they had or the events that took place on the train. You know, of course, you know, the duty train was a non-alcoholic train, you know, so it was kind of interesting that, you know, people would always have something on board the train, you know, and, you know, the British duty train, on the other hand, I really enjoyed that one because they had alcohol and they served dinner. I wish we would have had a dining car like the British duty train had. But in ours, it was mostly just a sleeper car, traveled by night. The British duty train did the corridor during the day and part of it in the evening time. So as the train commanders and the train conductors got off the train, they filed the reports with me. And I'd list down the events that took place, and if there was any incidents, I'd report them up the chain of command. And, you know, usually they were minor stuff, like, you know, the passengers were unhappy with a compartment, or they were treated rudely by the train conductors or the German train conductors, not necessarily our military train conductors, you know, or they were unhappy with the rail MPs because the rail MPs enforced the regulations, that type of thing. Most of our problems either took place before they got on the train or just after they got off the train, you know, in the processing procedures when there were bad flag orders, you know, and they couldn't board the train because the documentation wasn't correct and we'd turn them down for travel. And, of course, that would become an issue, especially if it was a senior person officer or NCO. Then they would escalate that up the chain of command and we'd have to jump through our hoops to make things happen and get things taken care of, you know. Typically, we could correct a lot of errors on the flag order, but we'd have to spend a lot of time doing that if there were many of them. And so, you know, one or two flag order problems, not too big a problem. We'd take care of it and handle it. But when you'd get a whole crew coming in, you know, 20, 30 people whose flag orders had errors on them, then we started delaying the train. And, you know, anybody that's familiar with the German railroad, whether it's the East German at that time frame or the West German Railroad, those things run like clockwork. You cannot miss your departure times and your stop times and things of that nature. If you do, it throws everything off schedule. And, of course, you know, the Americans were always to blame in situations like that. So, you know, we had to be very diplomatic, you know, in how we took care of situations like that. And you can never please everybody, you know, but that was just part of the nature of the game. And because Berlin was considered such a special place, people were the expectation. They expected to be treated specially. And you know, with the reputation that the brigade had, you know, you had to go above and beyond to, you know, help people and be courteous and give them the service that they thought they were entitled to in many cases. And sometimes they were and sometimes they weren't. But it was always fun to see those reports in the morning, and then, you know, you could cut off some of the problems early, or you'd have to give, like in my case, I'd report it up to the transportation officer up at headquarters Berlin Brigade, and a lot of times he'd be on the phone, you know, taking care of those ruffled feathers and calming the situation down, you know, things that we couldn't do at our level, and most of the time that's all it took, you know, but. Once in a while, you know, we used to have special rail cars that came into the city. For example, anytime we had a visiting senator or a dignitary, a diplomat of some kind, would come into the city, they would come in what we call a salon car. Now, a salon car was not your typical rail car. You know, our sleeper cars, comfortable, you know, some were pretty nice. Of course, the the cattle cars that we used to use to go out to the field and take the troops out in those sleeper cars where there were six berths and you put six people in a compartment. That wasn't the Salon car. The Salon car was literally like a Learjet, let me put it that way. You know, they had a dining room, they had a bedroom in there. It was designed to treat VIPs, and those were some pretty memorable people that that transited through the corridor. And we always try to put our best train commanders and best train conductors, the most experienced people on those trains, to provide support. And strange requests. I mean, you know, one unusual request we had one time was from, I remember, a senator's wife, that she wanted to have a special kind of tissue available to her while she transited the corridor on the train. You know, she had heard about how rough the toilet paper was on the duty train and in Germany. So she special requested a special order of toilet tissue and tissue for her makeup and stuff like that, that we had to provide for her to make that trip across East Germany into West Germany and back into the city. So, you know, there was always something that made it interesting, you know, and you sit there and shake your head back then and say, I can't believe they're requesting this. And then now I can look back and laugh about it. But back then, well, I'll tell you, you know, if you didn't make it happen, it was, you were scared to death that the command was going to come down on you. But those are just a couple of things that I found a challenge. You know, those are things that they don't train you for when you go to your transportation school or your supply school or your infantry school, whatever it was. You know, they didn't tell you you're going to have to deal with things like that. And so it was learn as you go and really try to figure out the solutions to people's little problems. You know, another example was that we had to have emergency rations on the duty train for, you know, if we ever got delayed, if we ever got stopped by the Soviets for some reason, we had to be able to feed people. So we had to have a list of emergency rations. And among those emergency rations were things like diapers, you know, and baby food and just a host of things that you could not believe that you would need. But MREs, of course, we kept a stock of MREs on there, and then we had to replace those every so often, just like any other unit does. But if the duty train had ever been delayed or taken hostage, we were responsible for the welfare of those people. And we actually had to provide for their security, their well-being. We had rations of water on storage on each of the baggage cars. So when the train conductor, after he was done his duties going up and down the train, taking the tickets, making sure everybody was content and comfortable and their tickets were processed, he would go back to the rail car, the baggage car, make sure everything was in order there. And then he would, one of his duties was to make sure that everything was up to date in terms of the emergency supplies. And that included mop gear as well. So, you know, if something would have happened and there would have been a chemical attack, we even had mop gear available for passengers. So there was, it's just those things that behind the scenes that most passengers never even thought about, but was thought about by the command should the events happen. Any questions, Dave?
Wow. What about cigarettes? So I'll carry up an emergency ration of cigarettes. So I knew some guys literally, they wake up before their feet even hits the ground, you hear that Zippo going off.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. We didn't carry emergency rations of cigarettes, but I know that most of the train commanders and train conductors always had something extra because people on the trains always wanted to smoke. And it was, you know, you could smoke in the aisles at that time frame. You couldn't smoke in the compartments, but you could smoke in the aisle of the rail car. And so it was pretty flexible. And we didn't allow smoking in the RTO itself during processing. So people would smoke out in the platform. But if you were in Frankfurt or in Bremerhaven, those RTOs did allow smoking because it was basically a German Bahnhof, so there was not really a lot to say there.
Oh, yeah, certainly. But no, and as far as the no alcohol rule, when did that go into effect? I'm kidding. There was no alcohol on my part, I guarantee it. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I know. We used to see a lot of people, they had taken part in their share of alcohol before boarding the duty train, you know, and they slept very well on the train that night, I'm sure. Oh.
Yeah, that was pretty much standard.
Yep. That was part of my routine. You know, if I went to Frankfurt, TDY for a day or two or whatever, whenever I went into the West, before I got on the duty train back, coming back into Berlin, I always had my beers there at the Bahnhof in Frankfurt and had, some Wurst or something out there at the little stands and filled up with food before I got on the train. And it was just, something memorable to do and enjoyable. And the other soldiers were traveling. We got together, we'd stand there and talk, and then we'd get on the train together. So it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, pretty much. That marble cake only goes so far, and that coffee only goes for so long. So, you definitely have to stock up going and coming back. And if you're not lucky enough to board in Frankfurt, you pretty much got stuck with whatever the local the town had at the railhead. So you kind of were like, better stock up before you go. Hey, you kind of alluded to it. You touched on it very briefly, but care to share some experience and some of the little things that we didn't know, especially about the British and the French duty trains?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to show you the contrast and comparison with that because, the British duty train, it pretty much ran the same course that ours did. You know, I can't remember exactly all the details on it, but it was really a social train. I mean, you'd get on train and they had passenger cars with just like if you're riding a regular German passenger train in the West, but they also had a dining car, and we always extended courtesies to the British officers and British NCOs that rode their trains, so they could come and ride our train anytime, and then they invited us to go on their train. So I went on their train several times. And passing through the corridor in the daytime was quite an eye opener. You know, you don't see a lot when we drive. When we go through, everything was usually pretty dark. And it's foggy and misty and snowy, so you didn't get a lot to see. I mean, probably one of the big events was when you went by the Russian tank brigade that was out there, and you could see the tanks sitting out there along their compound. And that was before we're in transit. And that was before we actually get to Marienborn, where you absolutely couldn't look out at all. But when you went on the British train, you could actually order a meal, and sit down and have a glass of wine. Of course, red port was their drink of choice. And here in the United States, we don't necessarily consider port a top of the line drink. But I'll tell you that when you have a nice meal like that and you have some red port or some white port, It's very nice, very relaxing journey, and you get to see a lot more of the countryside. You get to see a lot of really, the poor side of East Germany. It's hard to see it unless you cross over, and all of us know when we went to East Berlin the total difference between East and West. But when you travel the countryside and you see the people out working the fields during the daytime, it's pretty sad. And of course the pollution was incredible when you travel through the East. The smog was just so thick, but the courtesies that the British officers and the British would extend to the Americans on the train, for those that got the opportunity to come out on the British duty train, is just incredible. They treated us like kings and royalty, so when any time the British tried to ride our train, I made sure that we went above and beyond to give them the best service we could. And of course they slept most of the trip like most of the Americans did, but their trains were limited in the amount of sleeping berths that they had. They were more of a regular passenger train. So I don't know if you had a chance to do that with your family, Dave, but I know that those that did, I think it was a memorable experience. The French duty train, on the other hand, they did have sleepers. It was a little bit more modern than our trains, and they pretty much, the French, for some reason, we don't consider them this way, but they were pretty aggressive. They didn't like the East Germans or the West Germans to tell them what to do with their rail operations, and they pretty much did what they wanted to do. And their train was, ran at night. I think they had one train that ran through the daytime, but most of their trains ran at night as well. And so, I didn't have a chance to, but I think one time my family and I took the French train out when I went on leave, and then we were able to go all the way to Strasbourg on that train. So it didn't stop in Frankfurt. It it transited all the way into France. So it was a great trip. If you could book a ride on that train, you could see a lot of Europe. And of course, you know, with being in the island of Berlin Brigade and within the Berlin Walled City, we all knew that just to go on leave, you had to burn up at least one day just getting out of the city to get someplace where you could catch a plane out, unless you flew out of Tegel. So, but it was just an interesting way you could see a lot of Europe by taking advantage of all three trains at that time frame of the passenger trains.
Unfortunately, I was not able to schedule a time on any of the other Allies trains. So I've heard awesome stories about them, yours included. But it's interesting getting your perspective as basically comparing and contrasting as you know, you know the inner workings.
Right.
And that's pretty interesting. Wow. But no, that's one of the regrets I do have. I mean, I have several, but that one now just bumped up to the top of the list as far as not being able to ride the other Allies duty trains. Let's talk a little bit, and then we'll transition into the next big question. But let's talk a little bit about the it was called the ALPO? APLO.
Airport Liaison Office.
Mm-hmm. Airport Liaison Office. Can you give us a little bit more of other than just, hey, you know, that's the first people we see when we get off the plane, get off that Pan Am Clipper of the Sea or whichever aircraft we happen to land in?
Well, it was a very small operation. We normally had two people out there on a daily basis, and on weekends, you know, we'd rotate the duty, or we had somebody on call that could report out there if there was an emergency or somebody needed assistance. But the APLO is basically just like an assistance booth, information booth, where as soldiers came off the plane, they could find the airport liaison officer, usually an E6, or a second lieutenant, depending on the day, and they could get assistance in getting transportation from the airport into Berlin Brigade, whatever barracks they were going to. You know, normally we had a manifest of all arriving troops, so it was not like you were walking off the plane and you just had to find your way around. We knew when they were coming in, and we tried to have that NCO at the gate when you walked off the plane looking for you. And if you were, you know, in those days, we didn't travel too much in military uniform. You know, a few times people would come off in their Class A's but travel in BDUs back then was non-existent. You know, you just either civilian or military. And of course, our people were there to guide you, help you through, arrange your transportation, recover your luggage, and make sure you got to your final destination so that you got there safely. A lot of times the sponsor was there. The arriving soldier sponsor was at the airport. So they would marry up with our representative there and wait for the soldier to come in. And then they'd either transport them in, or they'd come in on military transport. And that was one thing good about the brigade. You know, the brigade always had a bus available for us, or the little minivans where if somebody came in, you know, our brigade transportation division always had vans available so we could pick up soldiers at the airport and get them wherever they needed to go. So, you know, the APLO, you know, in conjunction with our SATO office, the SATO was where everybody got their tickets to fly, you know, TDY out of, or to go on leave. You know, it's kind of like the ITT office. You know, you could walk in right there at Brigade Compound, at Clay Compound, walk into the SATO office and make your travel arrangements for air travel, you know, to go on leave or whatever your official duty was. So, you know, we always had documentation and manifests of whoever was going in and out of the city and for what purpose. And, you know, most of the time it was no big deal. You know, if you had an authorized DA Form 31 for pass and leave, you know, you could head out of the city. But if for some reason you were trying to get out of the city and you didn't have some kind of official authorization, then it would get sticky, you know. And we had a couple of those incidents, you know, where we had to called the MPs to come in and take somebody back to the barracks because they were leaving or coming in the wrong way, too. We also had people that mistakenly got on a flight to Berlin and weren't supposed to come into Berlin. So, you know, we had issues like that we dealt with both at the SATO, at the APLO at Tegel and at the RTO. The Bahnhof downtown in Berlin, we frequently had calls of soldiers that had come in or on leave into Berlin using a civilian train, and you know that was not allowed back then. So it was it always created some interesting stories, and of course we'd get them out as quickly as possible, put them out of the next train on the duty train, to get them out or fly them out. And you know how that goes. There's always our unknown soldiers that lived in Berlin, that lived in the BB housing area and in a certain building, and everybody knew they lived there, but they were unnamed, and their whole mission was, there was a top secret mission to help people get in and out of the city. So it was an interesting time, needless to say. And you think of Michael Caine and the Berlin Incident movie and all of those type of movies, and you say, well, you actually got to live those times during our tours in Berlin.
Oh, yeah. And we're still working on maybe trying to get somebody to say something, but nobody really wants to say anything. So that's okay. We're not going to push the subject. But, yeah, no, definitely. And as far as the APLO, yeah, in my case, I just quickly made a list of the individuals that came over with me from BASIC. That was our first assignment. And I'm like, there's Briggs, Garcia, J.R. Morast, myself, Borix, Rocha, Chaco. It's a bus. It's a bus. That's what took us in. And literally, I mean, and I know there was other people on the plane and with us, and it was a bus that took us there. And I do know that back then the order said show up in Class A. So that was the uniform. Say again?
Everybody showed up in Class A uniform that day, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was at when we met up there at JFK, we started we all met in the restroom there changing from civilians to the Class A's. So yeah, it was an experience. It's like, hey, I remember you.
Did you, you must have had a straight in flight from JFK, or did you stop in Frankfurt?
Stopped in Heathrow. Heathrow, and then went to Amsterdam, and then into Berlin.
Two stops. Yeah, I did the JFK to Frankfurt, and then into Berlin. So it was just a one stop, and I'd been in Germany before that, so Frankfurt was familiar with. But jumping on to Berlin was a little bit exciting, a different viewpoint. So the apprehension was there, but it was interesting.
Yeah, it certainly was. And there at was it Schiphol in Amsterdam? That was the first time I've been thoroughly searched in my life, and that was interesting. That was very interesting. Hey, you got to do what you got to do. And then when you mentioned there about soldiers getting on the wrong plane or getting on the wrong train, man, imagine if that happened today. Oh, it'd be worse.
Yep, it was interesting. I mean, the politics behind the scenes. I can't say I got involved with that, but I can tell you that I had friends that worked at the Provost Marshal's office and up at BB headquarters. That, they said, well, we didn't work last night because we had to save somebody and get them out of the city. And I know that I was on call, and I would get paged, and I had to call in and find out what was going on. And especially if it was somebody that had crossed over into the east and had to be taken out of the city quickly, we had to pack up their household goods, like that day. I mean, they had to be packed out that day and completely out of the city, like if they didn't exist. So, so I got a call at 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning. I would have to call our contract service, our carriers there in the city to come and start packing out a family and some soldiers and a family of soldiers to move out. And they would literally be gone from the city within 24 to 48 hours. So that was pretty interesting. I didn't get all the details, but I know what was happening.
Yeah, wow, and I bet you had some other duties that weren't so pleasant, especially knowing what was going on at the time. And one I know, we briefly talked about it off mic, and I thank you for bringing it up because it didn't even dawn on me until you brought it up. And so yeah, let's definitely talk about that. In this case, after the fact of Pan Am Flight 103, December 21st, 1988, the incident over the skies over Lockerbie, Scotland. Do you want to tell us about that?
Well, that was, I guess a lot of people didn't realize that we actually had passengers on that plane, at the time that the incident happened. It was the people from the brigade, the soldiers that were involved in that incident from Berlin Brigade, were actually soldiers that had opted to change flights. You know, they had tickets on other flights, and for some reason they either decided to spend an extra day in Heathrow and in London, or I think in one case a soldier decided to opt out of his seat and give it to somebody else on another flight, and then he ended up on flight Pan Am 103. And, you know, all of us know what happened there. And you know, that's just another incident of the war on terror as it was beginning to develop, where I believe, you know, our government wasn't looking quite as expanded that it would be. If you look back now in hindsight from 2011 all the way back to the LaBelle's disco bombing and Pan Am 103, you know, how they were all tied together and what the events would eventually lead to. But what was interesting was that you know, most of the time, you know, as a logistician, you know, we always hear about having to deal with casualties. You know, we hear about casualty assistant officers. And we had heard stories about Major Nicholson when he was killed in the East. And we had heard about soldiers or people escaping from East Germany into the West being killed in that attempt. In this situation, it was just soldiers going home on leave for the holidays, and a decision that they made put them in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now, you know, our command was notified through channels, I guess, that you know, that they wanted, of course, I think the entire European command was notified that they wanted to make sure that nobody was on that plane from the different commands. But when I got the call about the airplane crash, I was told, you know, to check the manifest, and that's what we did. We went to the SATO office, and we went through our list of soldiers that were transiting at the time and had flights within the last 72 hours to see who could have possibly been aboard on that flight. And our initial report to the brigade commander was, well, you know, we have no one on those flights, so, you know, we're good to go. Thank goodness, thank God that none of our soldiers were on that flight. Well, you know, reports, you know, kept getting confused, and we had another report that, yes, in fact, we had soldiers on that plane, and we kept trying to verify that information. But, you know, as it is, you know, the fog of the incident, you know, people were trying to put together manifests and match up names, and those names just did not seem to be coming up with us, but they were coming up in Frankfurt. And so, you know, for about 72 hours, we were literally, you know, really trying to figure out what of our soldiers were on there, how did they get on there, how did they get tickets for that flight. And and as it turned out, you know, we lost, I think it was three soldiers on that flight from the Berlin Brigade. Now, you know, it's not that we did anything wrong or that they did anything wrong. It's just the way the situation turned out for all of us. But in the scope of the command and accountability process, that was a big issue. You know, when you have soldiers that have been killed, and you know, their baggage and their flight records indicate them by name, and we can't match them up, it was definitely a painful period for the command, reporting to, you know, through channels to the Pentagon, you know, to casualty reporting system up in the Pentagon. And then coming back and having to, you know, conduct an investigation of the system and where there was a system failure that broke down, why we could not track these guys, and how that happened. So, you know, it was a sad incident. You know, the loss of life was incredible. And, of course, the United States is the one that lost the most lives on that flight, not just in military personnel, but the civilian people that were traveling as well, the students that were lost on that flight. So, you know, I can say that really taught me a lesson in terms of, you know, understanding that, you know, we really lose control of the soldiers once they leave the command. You know, once they have travel orders, they're just like any other citizen. They can, you know, if they're en route from whatever station to their home of record, if they want to change those flight tickets, they could. And there was no way that we would be notified. I think now, you know, we have systems in place now where, when a soldier does that, you know, the electronically, the computer systems update, and everybody would be able to see that visibility. back when that happened in 1989, that was not there, or 88. It was actually 88, December of 88. That system was not in place yet, so it did cause the whole transportation system, not just the military, but I think the civilian system as well, to really take a close look at how they tracked any changes in manifest. And unfortunately, you know, it caused a lot of grief for those families and those soldiers, the families of the soldiers that were lost. And you know, that's one of the duties that we had as commanders, as captains, as, you know, trying to maintain control of soldiers as they transited to and from the country, you know. And a lot of those lessons learned are applied, you know, each and every day now as soldiers come to and from the combat zones in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, I just think it was a lesson learned in that plane crash that has permeated the transportation system and the support systems of the military and the civilian travel sector. So, you know, while it was a bad situation then, it has been improved. But, you know, you were there at the time, and you know, many other soldiers were there, and we did have a memorial service for those soldiers. I remember that, and so it was a very trying time for us. And you know, and one of the things I always wondered, you know, being in an occupied city, you know, we're the only occupying first force in the world at that time, other than in Korea. You know, I think Japan was no longer an occupying force. So, and the rest of Europe definitely was not, you know, that, you know, we had soldiers that were killed in the Belle disco bombing. We had other soldiers that were killed in the process of executing their duties to preserve Berlin. And we were not really considered a combat zone, you know, or hazardous pay. But yet I think that because we were at the spearhead of the defense of the city, that, you know, that it was a political decision not to classify us that way. Whereas in Korea, it was a different story. You know, the threat was very obvious, and the aggressors were more out in the open. The aggression was more visible between the North and the South. So just the contrast, you know, just something I've thought about over the years and how that's impacted the military and the city of Berlin and overall the viewpoint of how soldiers were treated and the mission that we had in Berlin.
Yeah, it's one of those duties. I mean, again, you know, you well, I mean, again, look, I don't know what to say. It's one of those duties that, you know, it's not, nobody likes to have, nobody likes to be part of, nobody likes, but unfortunately that is part of what we, you know, we do, and part of what we signed up for is that something like that is going to happen. But in the bad, it's also good to know that good did come out of it. You know, it can't bring them back, but things have changed, and it makes things a little bit easier. And yeah, in this world of instant on, 24/7, 365, trust me, 72 hours is a lifetime. But you know that you've been right there. You know that 72 hours. Well, you lived it.
Well, the technology has just changed so much in since then that you know, this probably would not have happened. You know, we probably would have known about it sooner, been able to respond quicker. And so, you know, while we had the top technology back then, you know, the computer era was just coming to life. You know, emails were still unknown at that time frame. And, you know, while you had access, it was always slow to get information, even with the computer. And most of it had to be transferred by disk or files, you know. So times have definitely changed. And we really are a totally different army because of the technology and the lessons we learned without that technology. And now we have it.
Well, you know, I think that's pretty much that. I mean, it definitely, we've got some very good insight, very good stuff, information that, you know, a lot of us just took for granted. We showed up at the railhead, loaded up equipment, loaded up our gear, loaded ourselves up, and off we were. You know, we were gone. And yeah, I know we definitely had to stick to that timetable because just like the U-Bahn, the S-Bahn, and the buses, the BVG buses, you know, everything ran on a schedule and you didn't mess with that schedule. I mean, if the door shut, it wasn't an opening again, you know, and that was pretty much the deal. You either missed it or you're going to wait for the next one.
Absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, and I think overall, you know, I think a lot of times people look at the people that worked their RTO, and because they only saw them at the RTO, but we were definitely ingrained with the 502nd, each of the battalions, the combat support brigade, all of us were out there, and we had a mission within the city. Should something happen to the city, we'd respond right along with you guys, and it was a great pleasure supporting you guys out there at Doughboy City, and in, you know, the mission along the wall, and everything that went with it. So I think it was the greatest of times. I think it was probably the best assignment I had, and as a growing experience personally in my military career. And, you know, I wouldn't give it up or change anything for the world.
Oh, most definitely, most definitely. Kind of going back to your comments earlier about the special request, and you know, you get trained one way, and same thing with the infantry. You know, one day we're out there low crawling or running through the mud there at Doughboy City, and then later that afternoon we're having lunch with our congressman because he wants to come and visit the city. Okay. And boom, I mean, where else could you do that? Only in the military. And where else? Only in Berlin, because it was just that unique. But yeah, and again, that didn't train. We weren't trained in protocol. I don't recall taking a protocol class at Fort Benning. So, you know, again, you learn trial by fire and grace under pressure. But you know what? It's still, that's what made it special.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know what was happening from one moment to the next. And yeah, so again, from the top down, they pushed it that, yeah, it was a unique city. It was a special place. And so it kind of sunk into our heads. And that's kind of why we liked being treated special. But hey, you know, the support guys were always there. We didn't take them for granted. Not one. You know, I loved it when the buses met us out at the Grunewald. Mm-hmm. And I loved it when the train brought us back home.
Yep.
So that's a good thing.
It all tied us together, and that's what makes the military what it is today, and the brotherhood that it is. Because, you know, we can, you know, whether or not you had been there at the same time I had been there, the events, the things that happened in that city, can all be, whether you know, could have happened in 86 to 89 or in 65 to 70. You know, it just doesn't matter. They were all part of the same story.
Oh, exactly. It's just a different day on the calendar.
Right.
Definitely. Well, listen, everybody, we've been talking again to Colonel John Alvarado, United States Army retired, enjoying the good life over there at Rio Rancho, New Mexico. If you're in the area, he's already said he's got the door open. He'll fire up the grill and he'll cook you some. He'll cook up something, but nothing from the National Forest, because hopefully it'll still be there. But that's Captain. I'm sorry. Then Captain. Again, I demoted you one more time in two episodes now. Then Captain Alvarado, Rail Transportation Officer for the Berlin Brigade, and based over there at the RTO at Berlin Lichterfelde West Bahnhof. Thank you, Colonel. Thank you very much for taking time again. It's been an awesome conversation, and I just have this funny feeling we're going to be getting together and talking some more, because this has been a lot of fun.
Has been, and you know, I just want to thank you for all you do to keep all of this going and keeping it alive, because it's just a great service to all the Berlin Brigade and the people of Berlin too that follow you.
Oh yeah, definitely. Thank you, sir. Thank you. And again, all my guests, they've all been wonderful, you included. So again, you know, it's self-perpetuating, self-fulfilling, so it's all good. So I thank you, and well, again, thanks for your time, sir.
Okay, thank you much. Have a great day.
Again, I want to give a great big BerlinBrigade.com thank you to our friend John Alvarado for taking the time again to talk to all of us. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. Well, it's time to wrap up this episode of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. As always, I invite you to call and leave a voice message or audio comment on our BerlinBrigade.com hotline at 413-274-4233. That's 413-BRIGADE. Also, please don't forget, you can always send us comments, concerns, questions, reunion information, and of course, show ideas to dave@berlinbrigade.com. That's the email address, dave@berlinbrigade.com. Also, if you or someone you know that has something to share with us, please drop me a note at dave@berlinbrigade.com, and we'll schedule a date and a time for the interview. And before you know it, you're on the show. Also, I invite you to stay up to date with the latest at BerlinBrigade.com by visiting the website and following us on Twitter at www.twitter.com/BerlinBrigade, all one word. Also, you can like us on our Facebook fan page at www.facebook.com/BerlinBrigade, Or you can click on those links to get to those pages on the BerlinBrigade.com homepage. See, I told you to go to our homepage. So come on over, join our conversation. And before I go, I definitely want to say merci beaucoup, spasiba, thank you, and vielen Dank to all the website visitors. And I do hope you have enjoyed your visit to the BerlinBrigade.com website. And please, come back real soon. Everyone, that's it for the 40th edition of the BerlinBrigade.com podcast. I am your host, Dave Guerra. Thank you for spending this time with me. I greatly appreciate it. And I look forward to, well, have you join me again next time on the next episode. Listen, before I leave, we're still looking for the key to the clock tower. So if you know where the key is, please drop us a note. Other than that, until next time, danke, auf Wiedersehen, tschüss.
Sergeant Major, dismiss the brigade! The BerlinBrigade.com podcast is a Dave Guerra production. Thank you.